This is Richard Verone, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Mr. Martin Montemore. Today is March 27, 2003. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Special Collections Library interview room. Mr. Montemore is in Kansas City, Missouri. Sir, let's start with some basic biographical information. Could you tell me when and where you were born and just a little bit about your childhood?
Yes, I was born St. Joseph, Missouri, June 16, 1944. Mm-hmm. I think very typical smaller town childhood and environment. Went to private Catholic grade school.
Mm-hmm.
Very ethnic mixed neighborhood. Went to a Catholic high school, and after that, went away to college.
Okay. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
Two brothers and three sisters.
Okay. And were they older or younger?
All older except one younger sister.
Okay. Okay. And how about your parents? What did they do for a living?
My father worked blue collar for a meat packing plant.
Okay.
And my mother was a housewife.
Okay. Okay. What are your memories of your childhood? Did you work when you were young, or was it more play, or was it school? What are your memories?
Mostly, I think it would be school and play. I didn't work until I became eligible age-wise to work, mm-hmm, at the packing plant, which is where everybody worked in my neighborhood.
Okay.
When they became 18. So before that, I basically was just a school kid and did a lot of neighborhood things with neighbor kids.
Right. Okay. Tell me about what kind of student you were in grade school and on through high school. What were your favorite subjects?
English, mm-hmm, spelling, math. I was a good student in grade school. Top 10 in high school. Nothing outstanding, but seemed to work. Okay. I was motivated to work kind of hard at it. So.
Right. Was that external motivation or internal motivation?
I think it was internal. Okay. Yeah, I think it was more internal than anything else.
Okay.
Our family was rather large in the sense that we had with older brothers and sisters, there were always a lot of other children around,
mm-hmm,
and so it was hard for my parents or anyone to give anybody individual motivation or care, mm-hmm, or attention, so,
mm-hmm,
it was more of a group thing, and so I think that my motivation came mostly internally.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents emphasize education to you?
Yes, yes they did. Neither one of them had a high school education, but they were obviously from that generation that it was difficult.
Right, exactly. Did you have any relatives that served in World War II?
Yes. A lot of relatives, but two brothers.
Oh, both your brothers?
Right.
Okay. What did they do in the war?
My brother, oldest brother, was in the Navy, and they had combat. I'm not sure exactly what operations they were. I,
mm-hmm,
just know that he was in combat. He was 20 years older than I, and then I had another brother that was 18 years older than I that, mm-hmm, was Marine and also was in combat in World War II in the Pacific.
Okay.
Both of them were in the Pacific.
Did you talk with them about their experiences?
No, never did.
Really?
No.
Did you get to see them in uniform or...
Pictures.
Yeah.
No, I was too young. They were 20 and 18 when I was born. And
right.
So by the time I remember them, they were already out of the service and gone. They went,
mm-hmm,
to the service when they were like 17.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I never did talk to them about what they did, and they're both deceased now. So.
Okay. Okay. How about other relatives?
Just uncles and that... I'm of the age that the people that were a generation ahead of me were all the ones that went to World War II. So there was a lot of my close relatives that went, but then again, they were all gone and came back before I was even born, or about the time I was born in 1944. So I didn't know anything about it, and I really never did talk to them, anybody, much about World War II. And it didn't seem like to me. It just never became a topic of conversation, not because it was deliberately avoided, but it was just not something that was just that was more important to be talking about baseball or football or something else.
Right, right. Were you into sports as a child?
Yes, I did. I played football and baseball, and then in high school I played football, baseball, and ran track, and junior college I played football and ran track, and then I didn't do organized sports anymore, but I still do athletic things by just playing on our firm's softball team and working out two or three times a week, but nothing any high level, just try to stay active as well.
Right. What are your memories of high school? You said you were at a private Catholic school, is that correct?
Right, yeah, boys school. There was a lot of camaraderie, and I can, my best memories, I guess, would be those that have to do with athletic events and socializing at various school functions and that sort of thing. I very, very much enjoyed high school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thought it was a good experience.
Okay. And when you graduate, what year did you graduate?
1962.
Okay. What are your memories of the Korean War?
Boy, I don't have any.
Really?
Yeah.
I know you were young.
Yeah. Well, 10, I guess. But I don't know. I'm sorry. I really don't don't have any. I guess I really don't have any memory of it.
Do you remember President Kennedy?
And oh, yeah.
What are your memories of him? You were in high school when he was elected, and the missile crisis happens in the fall after you graduate.
Right, yeah. All very fond memories because, he was well-respected in our community, in my local community, because of the ethnicity, but also, because of that, but also because he was a Catholic and came from everybody considered at the time to be a fine family of brothers that did a lot for America, and I think he was probably the most respected and well-liked president that I know of, at least in my little circle.
Okay. When you graduated high school, did you have plans to go immediately to college, or did you want to work for a while?
I did work, I had planned to go ahead and go to college.
Okay. You said you worked at the meatpacking factory when you became of age, is that correct?
Right.
Tell me about that. What was that like?
It was good, hard work, very congested, very loud. You had to be physically strong and pretty much had to be mentally strong as well because of the environment of all the noise. And, of course, there's a lot of, animals being slaughtered and that sort of thing. So it's it's not a place for the weak of heart or weak of stomach or whatever. And but everybody there was good, hard worker that was trying to either raise a family or trying to earn some money to be able to continue their education. I'm talking about the people in the summertime that were basically the replacements for people that were going on vacation during the summertime, and that's what I did, was a summer replacement.
Okay. What were your duties there specifically?
I worked in the hog kill, working with heads, splitting hog heads with the machine.
Okay. Okay. And where was the plant located? Was it near St. Joseph or was
Yeah, it was in St. Joseph.
In St. Joseph. Okay. Okay. So after high school, you said you were going to go ahead and go to college. You went to junior college. Where did you go?
I went to a small college called Highland Community College. It's a junior college, a two-year college, which is probably 15 or 20 miles west of St. Joseph.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you study there?
Just the basic courses. I guess they would be called college prep courses type thing, where you take those if you were going to continue your education past a two-year level, then I took chemistry and calculus and those courses. But the basic courses, junior college, is not extremely difficult.
Right.
So it was the basic courses and a few college type if you're going to be college bound.
Mm-hmm. How did you do academically? How did you adapt to the college lifestyle?
Fine. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure I had a. I don't remember exactly, but I had always didn't have A's or B's. So I would say I didn't really change anywhere. To either go significantly up or significantly down, I think, anywhere in my academic career.
Okay. You were there from 62 to 64?
There actually just 1 year.
Okay.
And then I, my buddies had graduated, or had finished their second year when I had finished my first year, and so I wasn't... The school was I don't know, just too small, and with my buddies leaving, I just didn't want to go back, and so I was playing football and running track at the time, and so I just didn't show up for football practice, and moved to California for with three of my buddies, and we just went out there and worked for 6 months, and then I came back.
Okay. What did you do in California? What kind of work?
We had various jobs. Basically, we were 18 years old, and we'd work for temporary jobs doing whatever manual labor was around. The biggest job or the more stable job or the longest job I had was working shipping boxes from a Sears warehouse in Los Angeles.
Okay. How did your parents feel about you leaving school and going out to California?
We never really did discuss it, but I'm sure it was not very very well looked upon. Uh-huh. And looking back on it, it was probably a dangerous thing to do.
So when you came back after 6 months, what did you do then?
Started back at junior college in St. Joseph.
Okay, and this is in 1964?
Right.
Okay. Back at Highland Community College?
No, I'm sorry. I went to St. Joseph Junior College at the time.
Okay.
St. Joe had its own community college. And so I started my second year after that period of time of being out.
Okay.
Back at, and so I started, not back, but started at St. Joseph Junior College, and then I spent a year there and finished that program.
Okay. And then where did you go?
Southwest Missouri State University, which is located in Springfield, Missouri.
Okay. And did you end up graduating?
Yes.
From there? Okay. And what year did you graduate?
Let's see. I graduated 1967.
67. By this time, the United States had really become embedded in Vietnam and what was happening there. How much did you know of? Or how much did you follow American foreign policy, what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia, things like that?
I was aware of it only because of the media and the, basically the attention that was given to the daily skirmishes about, like, what's happening right now, I guess. And so from that aspect, I was exposed, but I was not learned. And nor was I curious about it. And so I didn't, I wasn't a, a national inquisitive person. I was more of just my own local community and mm-hmm. circles, and mm-hmm. So I guess my point is I was pretty politically naive.
Okay.
I think, which I would think that if I look back on it hard enough, I would think most of us were
mm-hmm.
as well. Politically naive, meaning that I don't think I had an opinion as to whether it was right or wrong or good or bad or
mm-hmm.
moral or immoral or whatever. It didn't really affect me.
Right. Were you aware of the draft?
Yeah, with the college, yeah, that was the thing that everybody was aware of
mm-hmm.
Because each local draft board had their own rules, and our particular rule was 4 years deferment for college,
mm-hmm.
eight semesters, and then once you passed that, then there was no more deferments.
Right.
So everybody knew that as soon as they graduated that, you know, your odds of being drafted were you know, 100%,
mm-hmm.
whatever, unless there was some physical or mental reason or whatever that you couldn't serve.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about that?
I don't think I had a feeling. I didn't want to go because, I mean, not for any reason. It's just everybody didn't want to go,
mm-hmm.
I think. I mean, that was just the general...
Right.
Consensus. I didn't feel like it was dangerous, immoral, or illegal. I just didn't. The military was foreign to me. I really had nobody close to me personally that was involved with any military or war except my brothers, and they were in and out before I even knew that they were in. So anyway, I guess my point is really didn't have. Didn't have a strong opinion, just accept that everybody basically basically would want to do something else other than that, if they could.
Right, right.
But everybody knew that was coming.
Right. So you knew when you graduated in 1967 that most likely you were going to be drafted.
Yeah, most likely. And then so I started graduate school because I had heard a rumor that they were going to allow some people to go ahead and continue schooling as long as they were doing well and
mm-hmm.
didn't have a break and that sort of thing. But so I enrolled in graduate school and worked for about 2 months, and then I got my draft notice.
Okay. So the rumors proved to not be true.
Right, they did not, right.
Okay, and this was the fall of 67?
Let's see. Yeah, that would be the, yeah. Let's see, yeah, it'd be fall of 67.
Okay. How did you feel when you got your draft notice?
Well, it was inevitable. Most people were looking for alternatives. So I can't remember if I... It seems like to me that I may have tried to join an Air National Guard unit Air National Guard unit. Well, actually, I think I heard that they weren't taking anybody, so I didn't really try.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow or another, I got a word-of-mouth contact from some recruiter saying that if you were a college graduate, and if you qualified, that you could go to Air Force pilot training,
mm-hmm.
But you had to pass a couple tests. And so I don't recall the exact contact that I made, but I do recall taking the what they call the Air Force Officer Qualifying Test, the
mm-hmm.
AFOQT, and then they had UPT, Undergraduate Pilot Training, Aptitude Test.
Mm-hmm.
Navigator aptitude test. So you took those three tests, and I remember taking those three tests
mm-hmm.
very shortly after I got my draft notice. I was then, I think within a week, had a basic physical. That may have been from my own doctor, or from a doctor that was not military at the time,
mm-hmm.
And with that I qualified, and so I joined in between the time that I got my draft notice and the time that I would have been sworn in and left.
Mm-hmm.
Was, I can't remember if it was a two-week period or a three-week period or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
In between that time, I was fortunate enough to qualify, so I accepted and went to the Air Force instead.
Okay. Why the Air Force?
That's who was accepting, but the Air Force, I don't know, that seems to me that was always the higher, the more professional, the classier
mm-hmm.
service of all. It just seemed like to me that they had the best jobs and
mm-hmm.
the best profession.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did you do on the tests?
I barely qualified. I did well on the academic part. The pilot aptitude and the navigator aptitude was slanted more towards somebody that had ever flown before,
mm-hmm.
and I had never flown in an airplane before.
Okay.
That's
interesting. You joined the Air Force and you
I'd never been. Yeah, I'd never flown an airplane, but I'd never flown in one either, so I'd never been a passenger on an airplane.
Okay.
So it was... I have a tendency to think, I don't remember exact questions, but I have a tendency to think that they were slightly looking for people that had some either high aptitude or some exposure or experience around airplanes, and I didn't have any
right
that.
Okay.
So I barely made the pilot. I did better on the navigator because it was more mathematic oriented
mm-hmm.
as opposed to pilot aptitude.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I know I just barely passed the pilot and did better on the navigator.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about going to basic.
Pretty uneventful.
Was this at Lackland?
It was in Lackland, yeah.
Okay.
It was officers training, what they call OTS, officers training school.
Mm-hmm.
6 weeks, I think, maybe, or 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Very fast, thrown in with people from, obviously, from all across the United States, and whether it's from New York or from North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
Very regimented, very strict, and very fast.
Yeah. How did you adapt to the military lifestyle?
I think I adapted well,
mm-hmm.
And I think probably because at that age I was just very adaptable. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I didn't question anything.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was time to get up at 5:30, I just tried to figure out how to get up at 5:30. I didn't try to figure out why I should get up at 5:30.
Right.
I mean, somebody told me to do it, and so I did it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you think back about your basic, what do you see in your mind's eye?
Again, I think I see the people that I was with. I don't really call any of their names. I do know they were from all walks of life and all different colleges, and everybody there was a college graduate.
Mm-hmm.
So I, they were. It was a very different exposure to me to be in that type of an environment without close friends, support group type thing. But I adapted very quickly, and
mm-hmm.
They became, my support group. And I think that's probably what I recall the most is again. I think. Probably the feeling of having a job to do and trying to get through it together.
Mm-hmm.
That being graduating.
Right, right. What do you think was the most challenging aspect of that training?
Well, I didn't think anything of it. I mean, I was. highly regulated, and of course there was a lot of physical things to that, but I was used to that, and so I really didn't have any problems with the physical part of it or the mental part of it or the academics part of it. I guess being so regimented, it was a disadvantage, but also an advantage to somebody like me because I could adapt to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really didn't think that there was. The challenge was just to finish. I don't think anything about it in particular that I'm looking back on it was particularly difficult for me.
Okay. How would you rate the training you received?
Well, the training in officers' training school I think it was adequate. I mean, I think it was fine. I mean, I don't know what else I would have said that we should do more of. I mean, I think they have to impart a certain amount of, military tradition and custom and practice and even things like how to march or how to salute or how to do the military things, I think are because it's a military organization. I mean, I think those are, looking back on it, I think those are probably important things to do.
Mm-hmm.
Going through it, you don't think that. It just seems kind of Mickey Mouse, and you don't feel like, well, why you need to know this or why you need to learn this or that, or whether it's marching or how to salute or how to wear your insignia or whatever. So, I thought it was adequate for what we needed, and it was just, I don't remember having any rest. I mean, there was no time that we were not doing something.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think they stuck probably 2 or 3 months worth of stuff in 6 weeks or whatever.
Right, right. Do you remember if any of your instructors had experience over in Southeast Asia?
I only remember one, and no.
Okay.
He had not. I mean, I don't recall, but I think that person stayed with us the whole time. By that meaning, he was a military officer who had certain, whatever it is, student squadrons attached, and he stayed with our student squadron the whole time, and no, he was not a Vietnam veteran.
Okay. Now, did you have aspirations to be a pilot, or were you looking at some other avenue of career in the Air Force? Or not career, but just another job?
Yeah. No, to be a pilot.
Okay.
Yeah, when we went in, most of us, well, I don't know if they did that, come to look at it, think back about it, and they may have done that on purpose. I don't know. It seems to me that all of my roommates, well, that's not true, I guess. Most of the people that I was with were pilot bound.
Okay.
Were pilot training bound. And come to think of it, there were some that were not.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought maybe they segregated them by career field, but I don't think they did. They just needed a lot of pilots at that time, and so that's why they took this, whatever it was, 3-month program and set it down to 6 weeks,
mm-hmm.
was to be able to rush it through so that, you know, they could have a pipeline of people that they needed for Southeast Asia.
Right, right. Did they tell you that, you know, you're probably going to end up in Southeast Asia, or...
No, I think it was kind of generally understood, but it was so far away that it didn't matter. I mean, it was so far in the future.
Right.
I mean, you wake up and you got to do whatever it is that day, calisthenics, or you got to do marching, or you got to do all whatever, or academics, or whatever it is, all is every second, so you don't even think about tomorrow, much less, you know, a year from now.
Right. Okay. So let me ask you about your parents. How do they feel about you being in the military?
Well, I think that they were probably, fairly proud of that. I don't know that, again, that No, they had a lot of time to be. Be thinking about individual people. Not that they didn't think about me, but I'm saying that I have just one child, so it's easy for me to devote all my free time to the one child. But they didn't have that luxury, and so I don't recall them encouraging me or discouraging me or saying that it's good or that it's bad. I mean, I think that it was a normal course, and they had, of course, two other sons that did exactly the same thing.
Right.
In terms of going into the military during a time when the military was at war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think it was a new and foreign thing to them, and I think they were fine with it, but I never did, you know, ask them or tell them, how I felt or ask them how they felt or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was not really a topic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you finished at Lackland, where did you go from there?
Went to undergraduate pilot training at Vance Air Force Base in Enid, Oklahoma.
Okay. And what was that like?
Very good, very, again, regimented, very standardized. Everybody did the same thing at the same time, wore the same clothes and took the same courses and did the same things.
Mm-hmm.
Very packed with high-speed academics, high-speed pilot training techniques and flying and all those things. I mean, we were doing that probably 10 or 12 hours a day every day.
Okay.
And so, it was, that's probably a good description would be to say that you had plenty of things to do and mm-hmm. not enough time to do them.
Right. How long did this training last?
1 year.
Okay. Had you been in an airplane before going to Vance? And at Lackland, did you actually get up in the air?
No.
Okay. So the first time you were ever in an airplane was
rolling down the runway at undergraduate pilot training in the left seat of a T-41 and when the instructor said, "You're airplane," mm-hmm. as you're rolling down the runway. So that was the first time I'd ever been in an airplane. Well, I flew it.
Oh my gosh.
It off.
How was that feeling for you?
It was a good feeling. I mean, for me, it was just a goal. I mean, it wasn't exhilarating, and it wasn't fulfilling, and it was just that was what you were supposed to do at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, determined to. Like everybody else, to do that. I mean, I didn't have a. Looking back on it, I think that it was probably a pretty good accomplishment. By the system to be able to take somebody that's never flown in an airplane to flying an airplane probably in about a two-week period of time, because when we first went to undergraduate pilot training, the initial thing that you do is that you check in and you get your place where you stay and you get a bunch of things that you know, your medical records and all administrative stuff for 2 or 3 days, and then you start with your classes, and then probably had a week of academics, and then we started our flying. And so probably in a week with their program. And, you know, you got an instructor with you, of course.
Right, right.
I think it's probably goes to show that they had that pretty well down by the time I went.
Mm-hmm. How was your instructor?
Good. I mean, each airplane you went to had a different instructor. But I would looking back on it, I would say generally that they were extremely well motivated with a lot of experience and a lot of I guess, ability to communicate. They're all pretty young, and most of them had just come back from flying in country. So the instructors were very competent and very professional, I thought. Yeah.
Okay, okay. What kind of planes did you fly and train in?
The first one is a T-41, which is the same as a Cessna 172, a single-engine prop reciprocal engine airplane. Then we went to a T-37, which is a twin-engine subsonic jet made by Cessna. And then we went to the T-38, which is a twin-engine supersonic jet, small trainer that actually the Air Force is using those airplanes today.
Right.
They're using some other ones, too, but they're still using those airplanes for certain people. And they put people that are going to cargo or transport airplanes in bigger airplanes in pilot training rather than the T-38, which is one that people that are going to go to fighters go through.
Right.
Which makes more sense, I guess, in the sense that you learn how to fly a twin-engine jet, supersonic, and then you end up going in a B-52 or a C-130 or a 141. It's a pretty big transition. So now they're having an interim airplane being a twin-engine larger jet for pilot training now.
Right. How did you do personally with flying? Did it come natural to you, or was it difficult?
I think it came. It came with some work. There were those in my class that were, I think, what you would call naturals. That it appeared like they just didn't have to work very hard, and I had to work pretty hard.
Okay.
But on the other hand, having some athletic background and probably more athletic background than most of my peers made a lot of the things I did, you know, easier, even though I had to work hard to get the concept or to get the feel or whatever. Once I got it, it seemed like I didn't have much of a problem.
Okay. Did your instructors tell you about what they did in Vietnam and talk to you about Southeast Asia and flying there?
No.
Really? Even,
no.
Even though all you guys were probably going to end up over there?
Right.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I think it was more... I think it was more lack of social contact.
Okay.
With them. I mean, every minute that you were with them was, you know, devoted to flying and talking about flying and, you know, and learning how to fly, not what somebody else did, you know. And so, I mean, I never had any what I would consider to be, you know, buddies. As instructors, they were all, you know, first lieutenants or captains, and they had their own social circles, and basically the students didn't mix with the instructors on that level, and so we really didn't have much of a conversation.
Okay. Okay. Did your instruction there for this year at Vance, did it help you when you got to Southeast Asia? Was it something that you could, I mean, obviously this is your learning how to fly, so how much did that help you in Southeast Asia? Or was it more your advanced training, advanced pilot training that's going to be more significant for you?
I think it was probably the advanced pilot training because I switched from a twin-engine jet which is very small to a four-engine turboprop cargo carrier. It was a big transition for me to get in an airplane that you could walk around in.
Right.
Was just I mean, it was just foreign. It was just so different from what I did before that, that training there was what really, got us to the level that we needed to be able to fly in country.
Okay. Did you make this transition in advance, or was it after?
It was after.
Okay. Before we leave your training in advance, are there any particular incidents that come to mind about your training there that you remember?
Looking back on it, I mean, I think it was it was quite a thrill to fly the four ship formations with the other students flying by ourselves at 30,000, 40,000 feet or whatever at very high speed and wings overlapping and 3 feet apart and all that stuff, and everybody does, everybody did it, everybody had to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was an exhilarating experience for the first time. I really got the feeling of flying, and it was rewarding in and of itself as opposed to just being another step along the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's really probably what I remember. And there again, you got a lot of camaraderie. I'm sure you hear that word all the time, but that's what happens when you get in organizations that are basically a closed society. We live together, we work together, we eat together, we sleep together, we fly together. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just natural that you get close to the people that you're that are in your class, and
mm-hmm.
so I guess that's probably the biggest general feeling, and specifically, I think flying the T-38 was just a lot of fun.
Right. Now, your ranking in that graduating class, did that determine whether you would go to fighters or to the four-engine transports?
Right.
Okay.
And the macho thing at that time was to go to fighters, and
right.
probably still is. It varies by class. Our class was mostly cargo bound. I think we had two fighters out of, 65.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't even close to that. I think I graduated probably in the top third, but not even close enough to think about a fighter. So my first choice was a C-130 because realistically they told you what airplanes were available.
Mm-hmm.
Then I guess the way they did that is whoever graduated first, whoever was first in the class, would then pick that airplane.
Right.
And then whoever was second in the class would see what's left and pick the next airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And you went down the line like that. And so by the time it got to me, number 15 or 18 or whatever, the C-130 was the best airplane left.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got a C-130. And they had some airplanes that were not so desirable to be flying
mm-hmm.
That were ended up the people at the lower echelon of the class
mm-hmm.
ended up having.
What were those airplanes?
What they call a C-123.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of them. Let me see there. At the time, a B-52 was looked down upon.
Mm-hmm.
As an aircraft to get. There were a lot of FACs, what they call forward air control airplanes, and I don't even know those designations, O-1s, O-2s,
mm-hmm.
the single engine, little Cessnas that people flew to basically guide the fighters in.
Mm-hmm.
They flew over the jungle, and looked for any movements or whatever. So those airplanes that were, I guess, less sophisticated, except for the B-52, mm-hmm. which is a pretty sophisticated airplane. But the problem with the B-52 at the time was that you set as a co-pilot, or at least that's what everybody told us, and I think it is true, set as a co-pilot for 3 or 4 years, you never got to fly the airplane. And so then after 3 or 4 years, you know, if you got out, I mean, that was it, and you never did fly the airplane. Or if you stayed in, then they would train you to get into the left seat as the aircraft commander. But everybody else would have already had their own airplane as an aircraft commander way before that.
Right.
So that's, I think that's probably why those airplanes were at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go for your C-130 training?
Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay.
That was at Smyrna Air Force Base. No, it was in Smyrna, Tennessee, actually, a little town outside of Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
We were there, and I can't remember the name of the base, but it's closed now.
Seward?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Seward Air Force Base, right. And from there, we were there for, I don't know what, probably 2 to 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Is this in 1969?
Yes.
Okay.
Because my class was, they go by numbers designation, my class was 69-01, which meant that I was the first class that graduated in the fiscal year 1969, which started, I believe it was August, at that time, August 1 of 1968.
Right.
So I graduated, I think, August 2, 1968. And so by the time I had leave and the 2 or 3 months of training, then I left for Southeast Asia in January, I think, of 1970.
Okay.
January or February, because we had, I forgot about that, we had survival school to go to.
Right.
First.
After Seward.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, after Seward.
Okay, so you end up going to Southeast Asia January, you said 70, is it 1969?
69, I'm sorry,
1969,
yeah.
Okay. Tell me about the C-130. What kind of transition was that for you, and tell me about the aircraft itself.
Well, the aircraft is, it's extremely large when you come from a little twin-engine jet like that.
Right.
It feels large, cumbersome, non-responsive in the sense of anything I had to compare it to. Now that I compare it to other bigger airplanes, it's actually a very good airplane, very responsive and very forgiving. It can fly slow, and it can fly low, and it can fly fast, and it can fly high. It can do a lot of things well. It doesn't do anything best, but it does everything pretty well. And so the transition for me was difficult at first. But it would be for anybody coming from pilot training. But it was pretty quick. You had to go through academics for 6 weeks or whatever it was, and then you flew the airplane as a co-pilot a few times. But they knew basically you weren't going to be doing a lot of flying right off anyway, and so you're going to get all your experience on the job. So they gave us adequate training, but not a quantitative large amount, and then sent us off.
Did you like the C-130?
Yes.
Okay.
Very much. Yeah.
Okay. I've heard it's a very forgiving aircraft.
Very forgiving. Yeah. You can. There's a lot you can do to misuse it, abuse it, or whatever. And generally speaking, it is one that will. Write itself, fly itself, help itself out of situations.
Right. Okay. What was survival training like, and where did this take place for you?
It took place at Fairchild, and you know, I'm getting a bunch of a bunch of looks in here that people okay. can't get to me. I was wondering, Richard, if I could set up a time. No, I was looking for a good break point.
Why don't we do that right now?
Is that okay? It seems like
absolutely.
To me the subject is changing to the which is a very interesting place if you've never been.
Mm-hmm.
Survival training is I was very very much impressed
mm-hmm.
by it, and I would like to not have to be in a rush and
absolutely.
I've had two or three of the other attorneys come in give me the sign. Is it a long one or a short one?
Right.
I've told them that I, that I'd be getting with them here in a minute or so. So this, I mean, if it's not, I'm very interested in it. I've got
mm-hmm.
I've got some other interview or other appointments today, and I was out all day yesterday in depositions, and so I'm apologizing.
This is Richard Barone, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Martin Montemore. Today is May 15, 2003. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the interview room of the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Montemore is in Kansas City, Missouri. Sir, we left off late 68, early 69, with you're getting ready to go to Vietnam, and you went to survival school, and you wanted to talk about your experience there, and I'd like to hear about it.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, I think survival school was probably the first real experience that made it an actual feeling that you were going to go to a hostile environment.
Mm-hmm.
Before, I think most of us felt the same way. Going through pilot training was our principal objective, and solely thought about how to pass the academics and the flying part of that, and how to do as well as you could possibly do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more or less non-reality in the sense that it was almost like going to college, where you just kind of made strides to do as best as you could, and
mm-hmm.
more or less the rest of it was just kind of fun and games. But then when all of us went from that environment to going to survival school, which everybody I think went to in Spokane, Washington,
mm-hmm.
it became less of a fun and games aspect and more of a reality that we were going to a situation in which we would be in harm's way, and certainly there was the possibility that that you would be shot down and captured. And
mm-hmm.
so the principal focus of that school was to prepare you for that eventuality. And I think most of us really hit us for the first time that what we were in for was not fun and games and flying airplanes for fun anymore,
mm-hmm.
but the reality that there were people on the ground that did not appreciate us being there, did not want us to be there, and were certainly doing their best to lessen our numbers of people that would be flying missions over there. And it was a bittersweet experience. I think that they did impart upon us the thought that even if you are shot down, which you're probably not going to be, and
mm-hmm.
which is certainly accurate, but even if you do, your odds of surviving are good, and going through this school would make them even better.
Mm-hmm.
They had a part of that school that did treat the pilots, the crew members, as if they had been shot down and had been captured.
Right.
And so there was about a three-day stint there in which you were a prisoner of war, and that really was a harsh reality as to what kind of treatment you could expect, and they did an excellent job of making it very realistic. And even though in the back of your mind you knew that you were still in the United States of America, and these people that had you were fellow Americans and probably members of the same or same military as you were, it was not conveyed in any manner, expressly or impliedly or any other way, that it was anything other than real. And so,
what did they do to you?
Well, they did a lot to humiliate individuals, and they controlled the group by, I guess a couple different ways. One is that they put everybody through certain things, like putting you in a very small box in which you could not stand up, set up. You could not do anything but fold in a ball, and you were blindfolded and I think handcuffed, but in any event, you're put in this at black box with nothing in it, and rolled in the ball, which is the only way you could get in it, and then they locked the door behind you, and you was in like a storage cabinet, except it was only about 2 feet high and 2 feet wide. And they put everybody through that. They put everybody through the being blindfolded and naked. They took off all your clothes, put you in the middle of a room, then made you stand there and then half sat down with your arms out. While they played Joan Baez and other other music, protest music, to you to, obviously break you physically or mentally, and they put everybody through that. They put everybody through a cell, and that's what they, but I think even almost more importantly to me, because that was kind of a group effort, you knew everybody was going through that, and, and you had that still I am the best in the world pilot, and I'm certainly young and strong, and I can get through this easily.
This is what you were telling yourself?
Right, right. That was the attitude I think that probably all of us had. But one of the things that struck me was that they would pick the, I guess what you'd call the leader of a group. There were maybe six or eight of us that were in one group that were captured at the same time, and there may be three or four of these same groups going through at the same time. And they would pick the best one. They'd pick the, like in our class, they picked a major who was an Italian guy, and I remember him being what I thought to be a very all-American personality, very outgoing, very good-looking guy with a good build, and certainly physically strong, mentally strong, a leader type. And then that's who they went after. So when they went after that guy, the rest of us, as an example, would all be in a bunker or something, and then they would pull him out and make him do things in in front of us and make him do extra work, and then they put leg irons on him and handcuffs on him, and the rest of us did not have those.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our example. If we got out of line or if we tried to escape, they accused him of trying to escape, and he kept saying, "I didn't try to escape," and he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't matter. Of course, that was what their point was. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, you're thinking, we know you were plotting, and we have somebody here in your group that told us this. There's somebody in this group that is reporting everything to us, and you're the one that's trying to do this, and we're going to make an example out of you. And they did, and it was remarkable to me that within a very short space of time, maybe one day,
mm-hmm.
that they had actually broken his spirit.
Really?
And it broke mine a bit to see that a guy that I thought was a little older, he was older, more mature,
mm-hmm.
To me, physically and mentally strong, emotionally strong, psychologically strong, the natural leader, and I think most of us were natural leaders, but he was the leader of the leaders,
mm-hmm.
and they broke him. And they broke his spirit.
Do you remember what happened to him and how you knew he was broken?
Well, he would no longer look up. He would no longer stare you in the face. He would no longer initiate conversations. He wasn't social anymore with us.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to, which they tell us to do. One of the things, they tell you how to try to deal with it, but
mm-hmm.
one of the ways is to keep a low profile.
Did they tell you this before the school started or during the school? Was that part of the training?
It was part of the training, was a classroom academic thing for a day or so, and they taught you how to kill a rabbit and how to eat a rabbit if you're what they call E&E, which is escape and evading,
mm-hmm.
and how to live while you're on the lam, or so to speak,
mm-hmm.
trying to avoid capture. And then they also told you, in general, how to deal with a POW situation, in the sense that, in general, you want to keep a low profile, you want to not stick out, you want to not do anything that would be extroverted.
Mm-hmm.
You want to complain, fake illness, fake injury, any of those things to try to curry some kind of treatment that would not be harmful to you physically, yet all the while it's only name, rank, and serial number. You're not allowed to curry favor by any remarks that could be considered derogatory or detrimental to the United States, and
mm-hmm.
giving them any information and all that stuff, which I thought was, looking back on it, which I thought was really, and still is, extremely wrong. I think they should tell everybody that if you get shot down, you spill your guts. You tell them everything they want to hear. You tell them that the United States is bad. You tell them that you're bad. You tell them that we shouldn't be there. And then we'll tell the world that we told you to say all that.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of breaking you to get you to say what you're eventually going to say anyway or die,
mm-hmm.
I think it's better handled in that way. But in any event, that's not, I guess that's not the issue. It's just that at that time that there was no fraternizing, and anybody that did was really looked down on. And even though McCain and others spent 3 or 4 or 5 years there, while they were giving their interviews to the press and talking about how the United States should not be there and it was a mistake and all that stuff, going through all of that and then saying those words, and I think they were pretty much very much looked down upon by the other military that were not prisoners of war, that they would actually go so far as to say those things that were derogatory about the United States and about themselves and their part in the war. But I guess that all came from survival school and them instilling upon you that it's your job to try to stay alive, but you still have these rules, and these rules are in effect no matter what.
Right.
And so I guess from that aspect it was striking to me, the number one, that it was a wake-up call that where we're going is real.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this possibility that may happen to you. And here's a little bit of a taste of it and a little bit of how you might deal with it. And to see the various experiences that I felt and saw in others was for a guy out of St. Joe, Missouri, that had never been anywhere except college and
mm-hmm.
pilot training, was really a mind awakening experience. And so I think it was a good experience in that respect, that it's hard to describe to anybody that hasn't been through it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't unique because we all went through it, so it wasn't just 10 of us that you know that may get into an astronaut program or get into something. It was everybody that went through survival school.
How long did it last?
I want to say probably a week. There may have been a day of academics, and I think then there was like 3 days of being out in the you simulate being shot down, and then you're hiding and evading and trying to survive out in the mountains
mm-hmm.
of Spokane, Washington, while they're looking for you. Then everybody gets captured on the third day out, which is like the fourth day.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets captured, even if you didn't get captured in the meantime, and some people did. But at the very end of those 3 days, you had to go to a certain point on your map, and that ended that part of the exercise, but it started the new part,
mm-hmm.
point, which was, at that point, then you became a prisoner of war, and you were there for 3 days.
Did you get captured in that initial few days, or did you get to actually report unscathed?
I got to the end. They... I'm convinced that the area that we were in was rather large, but of the hundreds and maybe even thousands of people that have been through that
mm-hmm.
training, and the people that are looking for you know every inch of that
mm-hmm.
Of that land. And there were times when I'd be hiding in a ditch, and there would be a couple of guards would walk by within 5 feet of me while I had my head down
mm-hmm.
in the ditch, barely covered by much because there just wasn't much to cover you.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you were doing that, they wouldn't capture you.
Right, but you think they probably knew you were there.
Oh, yeah. I looking back on it, there's no way. I mean, I could hear them talking as they mm-hmm. walked by me within a few feet, and I'm just kind of laying there in a ditch out sort of in
mm-hmm.
the open, but I've got my head down and crouched and attempting to play the game. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's not a game. You know, it is a game, but it's not. I mean, you're really doing it. But I think if you coughed or if you made a break for it or something that would be stupid, I think that they would say, okay, you're caught.
Right.
So
Those who were caught, did they start the POW experience earlier and have it longer than the rest of you?
They did. I don't know if they took them to a holding camp or what. I don't know that they actually didn't start the POW camp early.
Okay.
Because we all started at the same time, but there were people that were already there when we got there, and I think they just put them like in a holding camp,
mm-hmm.
waiting for the time to expire.
Okay.
And they certainly didn't catch anybody on the first day or whatever. They wanted people to get the experience of evading
right.
capture. So and I don't know of anybody that didn't play that. I mean, didn't attempt to do exactly what you're supposed to do. So I think there were a few people that were caught, but I think that it was basically because they did something rather silly or stupid that
mm-hmm.
made it so obvious that they had to do something, and so they would capture them and put them in a holding camp to wait for the rest of us.
Overall, how do you think you did with the survival training personally?
I think I did a good job. I kept a low profile. I was a second lieutenant. I was not particularly tall or heavy or old or wasn't a major, or I didn't have any features that would make me stand out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I was able to blend in with the non-observables, and so I did not receive any treatment that was any worse than anybody else, although some did.
Mm-hmm.
And normally it was the people that, for whatever reason, you felt were the best of the group or the leaders of the group or potentially the leaders of the group, those that were obstinate, stubborn, and wouldn't do, as in, if they said stand up as an example, if somebody would sit out, you know, somebody would sit down
mm-hmm.
just to defy them. Those were the people that received extra treatment,
mm-hmm.
and so you learn pretty quick to do what they say and to keep a low profile.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is on the eve of you reporting over to Vietnam,
right? Yeah, I think I want to say it was like November, and I went to Vietnam in January.
Okay, what did you do in the intervening time there between going overseas?
They gave us leave.
Okay.
I think I might have had a 15 or 20 day leave mm-hmm. back in my hometown, St. Joe, Missouri, and it was like okay again. You know,
mm-hmm.
it was just an experience after you went through it. But I think that most of us, we just had our pilot training reunion, our 35th pilot training reunion last week in Scottsdale, and people still kind of talk about that experience.
Really?
Yeah, it was just a week. It was, I don't know of anybody that doesn't have several stories
mm-hmm.
about it that they recall, even though pilot training more or less seems like a blur.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a year, and survival school was only a week, but I certainly recall more of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did your parents feel, your family feel about you going to Vietnam when they knew, you know, your orders are cut and you had just a leave here and then you were going over? How did they feel about that?
You know, I've actually thought about that because now I have my own child,
mm-hmm.
and because I started late in life, he's young, but someday he may have that same situation.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody said anything to me about it. My father and my mother, either one. I had two older brothers that were in World War II. I think it was just more or less expected. I don't think it was it just wasn't broached. The subject wasn't broached. We didn't talk about it. Nobody told me of course, be careful. But I mean, nobody said, well, this is war and this is Vietnam and wow, whatever. I mean, I think it was just, oh, okay, well, the next step. And didn't have the communications you had then and that sort of stuff. So there was not much interaction after you left. So before I left, I think it was, looking back on it, it had to have been traumatic for, my parents. Mm-hmm. But they didn't let on, and I didn't. I mean, they didn't tell me that. And it certainly wasn't traumatic for me. It was just the next step.
Okay. How did you feel personally about getting ready to ship off to go to war?
I thought it was exactly what was supposed to happen. We'd gone to pilot training, and everybody knew what was going to be the final result of that, which is, I think, probably, out of 55 of us, probably 52 or 50, maybe even 53 went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
That was not a unique experience. None of us were singled out for that. It was pretty much understood before you went in there, although the main job was to get through it and not to think about what happened afterwards. But mm-hmm. we all knew that that was going to be it. And I think that I looked upon it with great anticipation as kind of a new adventure. I think I had a friend that was going over with me on the same airplane that we went to Taiwan in. Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying on the way over there that he was not going to like this. And it was just not going to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right for him.
Right.
Because he already had his mind made up, whereas I went and looked upon it as something wide-eyed and new, and it was a 13-month tour, and I extended twice, so I actually stayed two extra 6-month tours,
mm-hmm.
so I was there for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
just because I was a bachelor, and I had my own airplane, basically. We flew all over the world to places that nobody would ever dream of going. Hong Kong and Bangkok and Tokyo and Jakarta, Indonesia, and Kathmandu, Nepal, and Calcutta, India, and Lake and Guam and Midway and Hawaii, places that I would never be able to think about going. I was able to fly my own airplane there. And so I guess my point is, the way I felt about it, I think I had an open and a good attitude, and it worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you know or understand of why the United States was in Southeast Asia in the first place?
I don't think any of us knew. I guess none of us ever talked about the politics that I know. I mean, I never talked to any other pilots about whether we should be here or not be here or whatever. I think most of us thought that this was just a job. Not a job, but it was our job, our duty. So we really didn't broach the issue. Couldn't understand why people at, as an example, KU or any campus or whatever, would demonstrate against United States Air Force pilots. I mean, I'm thinking, well, that's me, and what the hell are they talking about? I mean, why would they protest against me? I'm just Marty Mahmoor from St. Joe, Missouri, and I'm doing what I'm told, and it's not my choice. I mean, it's not my they told me to come here, and of course I'm willing to come here and do what they tell me to do. And I don't know. I didn't have any moral judgments. I guess I was just surprised that there was this demonstration. I kind of took it personally a little bit because I happened to be the baby killer or whatever they called everybody at the time, just I think looking back on it and looking at this latest few wars that we've had, I think people don't disappreciate the military anymore. They may not be in agreement with the government's decisions, but they don't take it out personally on the military, which they did in Vietnam.
Right. Looking back, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, so that's changed, I believe.
Okay. Looking back on the anti-war movement, has your opinion changed at all?
I don't know. I still feel a little, somewhat offended that they would demonstrate and express displeasure over me personally, meaning Air Force pilots, of which that was that group. There was other people that they voiced displeasure with too, but that somehow or another it seemed to be a recurring theme, and maybe only because I was in that group did I pay more attention to it as opposed to special forces or paratroopers or tank people or whatever. But I still have a feeling of a memory of not understanding why that would be, and some resentment, I guess. I mean, I'm not going to go out and do anything, but I mean, that's changed,
right,
from what it was back then, and I think, you know, probably for the better. And certainly, there were a lot of very, very, very good people here that protested the war, and I think protesting the war was different than protesting the military. And some did not have a bright line that got became blurry, and so they protested the military, thinking that they were protesting the war, I guess. Then I think there was a lot of that that was just because we're on campus and 1,000 people are getting together to have a deal, I think I'll just join that and have some fun. So I don't know if they knew about the politics of the situation. I certainly didn't. I had no opinion and didn't. I mean, I didn't. It wasn't for me to question or know about, and I just basically did like everybody else, which is just do what you're told, and that's fine.
Did anybody in your unit ever talk about what was going on back home while you were over in Southeast Asia?
You know, no. I you get so isolated over there that and you're pretty busy and doing stuff, and when you're not doing stuff, you're relaxing, or I mean, you're letting your hair down, and you're not sitting around. There's no sitting around and talking about politics for an hour or whatever. I remember seeing TV, you know, maybe 10 times in 2 years. I'd at the officers' club. Occasionally, somebody would mention something about there being a demonstration or something, and maybe you watch 10 minutes of it or whatever. But otherwise, you're drinking, playing cards, and socializing and whatever. But and then the rest of the time, you're flying and sleeping and eating and and it's just. You know, that's more than intellectualizing or watching TV or anything. They just didn't have the, they didn't have them much.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about getting over there to Southeast Asia. You went to CCK in Taiwan. How did you actually get over?
They had a charter airplane, a DC-8, that I think we all made our way to SeaTac, Seattle, Tacoma. And then maybe they had one or two flights, maybe a day, I don't know, that would go to, I think we went to, Korea, and then to Japan, and then to Taiwan, and maybe then to the Philippines, and then all along that way they would drop whoever was assigned to Korea or Japan or to Taiwan or to the Philippines, and it was just a regular Continental or United or whoever it was airplane that they chartered, and it was full just of military people, all the way from, you know, clerks, enlisted people that were, you know, just doing office work, whatever, all the way to fighter pilots, or whatever job and whatever base. And it was just strictly transportation. It wasn't, you know, very luxurious or anything, but it was a nice airplane. And I don't know, it seemed like to me it took like 14 or 15 hours to get there.
What was the mood on the plane like, do you remember?
Yeah, I think it was fairly quiet. It was not somber. It was not dread. It was just, well, I wonder what we're getting into now. I wonder what's next.
How did you feel?
I think I probably, I think I recall thinking that same thing, that I just wonder what's next.
So you arrived in Taiwan. That's where you were dropped off?
Yeah, in Taipei.
Okay.
And
what were your first impressions of getting off the plane and coming into Taiwan?
Well, you know, I'd never been in a foreign country, so it was quite an experience. Yeah, it's almost like it's a movie set. You know, you wonder if it's really real. And it is. It's not there for you to see. I mean, it's there because that's the country. And it's not a Disneyland or whatever that you go to look at it and then you leave and one, you know, you see the rest of the of it's just like where you're from. And that wasn't accurate. And so I think I was a little taken back, not having been exposed to foreign countries, foreign cultures, and foreign race, and yet there was nothing that was scary or ominous or anything else. It was just, and I thought that everybody was respectful, almost accommodating. At the worst, they would ignore, but nothing that would make you feel like they were hostile.
Talk about the Taiwanese.
Yeah, there was nothing that was made there was nothing that was ominous about it. It was great.
Okay. What were the first few days like? What did you do?
Got used to the base. They think they had a base orientation, and they kind of just showed you where you lived and where the officers' club was and where the athletic fields were and the BOQ and the BX. And then you had to sign in. You had to sign like 50 different things and get issued stuff and whatever, all the things that you needed to fly with and everything, because you went over there with just, you know, a few clothes and really nothing else to take.
Were you welcomed into the unit?
Yeah, they would. They had one, what they called a sponsor or something. So you met somebody, or they met you, and they would take you around that first day and kind of show you where to go and what to do and that sort of thing. And then there's so many people that came in every day and then left every day that it was. I mean, it wasn't a personal private deal. I mean, it wasn't. It was. There were just so many people coming and going that they did their best to try to make it something personal. But it was more of a, you know, here are the things you need to know, and unless you got any further questions, I'll see you later.
Okay. How did you find the morale overall when you first arrived?
Good.
Okay.
Yeah, it was good. It was fine. I mean, people were, I mean, I think you had the people that were old heads, the people that were experienced, been there for a couple, 3 months or more.
Mm-hmm.
And you just wonder if you'll ever be like that, you know, or
right.
if I'll be that good or that experienced or feel that comfortable or whatever, because they kind of have an attitude about them
mm-hmm.
that was good.
You want to take a break?
Yeah, actually, it's about that time. I'm sorry?
I said it's about that time.
Yeah, it is. Unfortunately.
This is Richard Verone, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Martin Montemore. Today is July 10th, 2003. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Montemore is in Kansas City, Missouri. Sir, we left off with your arrival at CCK in Taiwan, and this is in January 1969. I wonder if you could kind of give me a description of the base itself and where you live, what your quarters were like.
Okay, sure. I think I was surprised by the magnitude of the base. It was a very large base with a lot of acreage, a lot of space in between buildings and in between facilities, something that we don't have as much of at the base as I was before.
Mm-hmm.
It was not only a large base in acreage, but it was a very large base in quantity of people. There was, it just seemed like row after row after row of C-130s. I remember looking out over the flight line as I pulled up in the bus that they sent to pick us up there at Taipei.
Mm-hmm.
It's about an hour drive south of Taipei to get to Taichung, which is where Ching Chuang Kong Air Base is,
mm-hmm.
Commonly called CCK. In any event, I was very impressed with the newness of it and the largeness of it. The quarters themselves were about what I expected, fairly not luxurious, fairly simple,
mm-hmm.
A bed and I think we might have had a radio and a window and maybe a dresser and access to a lavatory and a shower, and that was about it. But we spent zero time at CCK, basically.
Okay.
We're always gone. So it was very much more than adequate for what we used it for.
Would you go into country for a certain amount of time, fly around, and then come back to CCK?
Exactly, yeah. The way they worked it, and I think the reason, well, not only because of security, but also because they were limited in the amount of people that they could have actually stationed in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
so that if they had bases, which they did, had bases in Taiwan and in Okinawa
mm-hmm.
and in Japan and Philippines and other places, Guam, those people didn't count
mm-hmm.
as being stationed in Vietnam. So I would assume that there were more people outside of Vietnam than there were inside of Vietnam, and they kept numbers on those that were stationed in Vietnam. Of course, by far, the largest majority of people that were stationed in Vietnam were Army infantry,
mm-hmm.
Whereas the people that were stationed outside were Air Force and Navy, by far.
Mm-hmm.
But for all of those airplanes, obviously, you need a large support staff, which includes not only people that work on the airplane and that sort of thing, but also people that order supplies and people that are veterinarians or doctors or dentists or mm-hmm. whatever. So you have basically a city that's self-contained with recreation and medical facilities and food food and restaurants and whatever else you need to keep a city going.
Mm-hmm.
And so that basically was it, and it was, so they were large. They were large bases with large amounts of people, and they were outside of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But what we would do is, I'm sure others have told you, we would go from these outlying bases into country,
mm-hmm.
And we would spend anywhere from, I think it was 25 to 30 days at a time,
mm-hmm.
then come back out for 2 or 3 days, and then turn around and go back.
Okay. When you would come out for those 2 or 3 days, you would go back to CCK, is that right?
Yeah, and then from there, it wasn't always go back in country because there were other places that they sent airplanes.
Right.
So we had the ability at that time to go to many places, many places that you know, the average person would never get a chance to go to, meaning we had trips that went to Hawaii, and we had trips that went to Hong Kong and
mm-hmm.
Bangkok and Tokyo, and I even went to Calcutta, India, and Jakarta, Indonesia, and Kathmandu, Nepal.
Wow.
And so if you got lucky enough to be on a rotation and come out of country just when they were having a trip to go somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
then you would be eligible, obviously, you know, to go on that.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say lucky enough to be doing that?
Well, because it was random. You never knew when a good trip to a place like that would come up.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're lucky enough to hit the rotation so that it happened to be the 3 or 4 days that you were coming back, that trip was scheduled to leave,
mm-hmm.
then your odds were great of getting it, because there were not very many people back at CCK compared to those that were in country, because
mm-hmm.
you spent 30 days in country and 3 days out,
mm-hmm.
and everybody did that. So if you didn't, you know, if that trip obviously was scheduled to leave at a time when you were already gone,
mm-hmm.
you weren't going to be lucky enough to get on that one.
Right.
So that's what I mean. I got lucky on a couple of my rotations and came back basically at the time they needed somebody to leave.
Mm-hmm. And these trips outside, going to other places in Asia, these were desirable, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Versus flying in South Vietnam.
Well, yeah, and it's not, well, I guess it's just because of, well, that was a personal thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I very much looked forward to it and very much enjoyed it, but of course I was, you know, fairly young, and I was, you know, single, and I wanted to see places and go and visit places and that I'd never been, so for me it was that. It wasn't so much that I didn't want to go back to Vietnam, because that I never thought about that one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But it was nice to be able to go to some places that, you know, probably I'll never get to again and never have been before or since.
What kind of things would you haul around to these other stations outside of South Vietnam?
They had what they call embassy runs. A lot of times you would pick up supplies, meaning things as minor as food, maybe household supplies.
Mm-hmm.
Even mail, and sometimes furniture, and evidently they had not very much support or an ability to get American products or get American supplies or whatever to some of these countries,
mm-hmm.
and so they would dedicate a C-130 about once a month to go to the Philippines or someplace, and deliver things much of the time the airplanes were not full by any, because the C-130 is huge and carries a lot of stuff, but it was kind of a regular route that they would fly around the various United States embassies in these countries and kind of bring a piece of home to them. And then when they rotated back, I guess rather than pay freight or whatever, sometimes they, the 130s would go up and pick up all their furnishings and clothes and whatever they were shipping back from Indonesia or wherever, and deliver them back to some place where then put them on a ship. But the one time that I went to Kathmandu, Nepal, was when we took an advance party because I think it was Nixon was meeting with Key or Two or somebody, and they had a kind of a, I guess you'd call it a summit meeting or whatever. And I wasn't involved in the politics, and I don't remember all the things, and I didn't care to know all the things. It didn't matter to me anyway. But it happened to be that that's where they chose to meet, was in Kathmandu. So I think we took a small cadre of security people. I think it was a few people that did kind of route searches and to see where secure places were, to see if there was any weak areas where there could be some physical violence or some sort of an attempt to kidnap or assassinate or whatever. And so they have these forward parties that go out and
these advance teams.
The advance teams, exactly. That's the term I was looking for.
Right.
And so we did that, and I think they also, we had one guy on there that was a, I think he was a, who was a student at, like, Southern Illinois University, and he was the head of the Young Republicans or whatever, and somehow or another, he got chosen by lot or lottery or by design, I don't know, as a reward for his hard work or whatever, and send him over there to witness, I guess, this this meeting. And so it, I thought it was kind of funny that here we were with a C-130 and this huge airplane with this combat crew coming out of Vietnam and taking this airplane and taking him and a couple other people, basically, and their suitcases from Manila to why we went through, I don't know, we went to Calcutta and then to and well, we went to Jakarta, Indonesia, then to Calcutta and then to Kathmandu. Why we did that I don't know, but maybe that was because of fuel or because we were picking something else up or dropping something off. I don't remember.
But you remember this kid?
Yeah. Yeah, this is like a 19-year-old kid. Right. He had his own airplane. He had his own C-130.
Right, right. Where was the most interesting place that you went?
I think probably Kathmandu.
Really? Why?
Yeah. Well, it'd be just because it is so very close to the Himalayas. It's in the Himalayas and so very close to Mount Everest. And it was the day that we went there. It was a bright, clear day and beautiful weather, and so we were able to fly right up to Mount Everest.
Wow.
At 15,000 feet. We were what they call VFR at 15,000 feet flying towards Mount Everest. Probably got about 30 miles away and before we turned around, but at 15,000 feet, you're pretty high up there. And I remember thinking, well, if we went straight ahead for another 5 minutes, we would hit that mountain about halfway up,
right?
And because it's 29,026 feet high, and so it's a unbelievable sight. Then when we landed, of course, having a C-130 come into a small airport in Kathmandu was a very small town, very small village, and I assume it probably still is very. I guess it would very devoid of the luxuries and the modern conveniences and that sort of thing. So it was quite a sight I think we probably brought out the whole town to the airport to see the C-130, and we've got pictures of them crowding around us, and it was just quite of an experience to be there. And we were only there for one night, but it was an extremely interesting place, both physically and culturally, to go.
Let's talk about when you would fly in country in South Vietnam. How did you, first of all, about your airplane, about the C-130, how did you think it performed overall while you were there flying in country in a war zone?
The C-130, I think most people would tell you, is that it's an extremely capable airplane. Really does more than what they advertise it to do. You hate to ask for it to do more than it's advertised to do, but sometimes you inadvertently get into a situation that requires the airplane to do a little bit more, carry a little bit more, get off in a little shorter field or land in a shorter field than you had anticipated, because your weights or whatever else or your distribution of your load is off, and you don't know that. There's no way to know how much something weighs, because somebody else weighs it, and they tell you that, and they put it on a pallet, and they put it on your airplane. Does it really weigh 3,000 pounds, or does it weigh 4,000 pounds? I mean, some kid is doing that, and he writes a 4 instead of a 3, or he doesn't. They don't even weigh it, or they guess, or, you know, you don't know. I mean, there's no way to know. But the airplane itself, is, I think they would call it a workhorse, very forgiving airplane. You can do a lot with it without it punishing you, as opposed to the single seat swept wing jet fighters have got a low threshold for error and a low threshold for deviation, and once they get to that point, the airplane will not forgive. Will not forgive you or itself, and so I guess I'm trying to compare the 130 to other aircraft. It was about the probably the safest airplane you could have flown in Vietnam.
Okay, tell me about your missions and what kind of things you were taking in and out of country.
Well, in and out of country wasn't a lot. Occasionally, we would pick up ordnance or people that would. That would be in other countries, like in Japan or in Okinawa. If they had something, a lot of times we would stop on our way in country and go through the Philippines or through Okinawa and pick up a load of something that was going to Vietnam. Most of the stuff that went to Vietnam, I think, went by other aircraft. To the big bases at Tonsonute and Cam Ranh Bay and Da Nang, and then we would pick up our whatever it was, and a lot of times it was food, a lot of times it was ammunition, and a lot of times it was people that were going from or landed at Da Nang, say, and they were going to Pleiku or some other base in Vietnam, and that was the way they got there. Was they would land 141 or 707 or whatever in Da Nang or Saigon, and then we would pick them up there and take them to their final destination, in Vietnam.
So what were those typical things that you would carry in country from base to base?
From place to place in country, that we were always loaded. There was always a full airplane, almost always. And the C-130 actually carried... it did a lot of missions, but my missions were transport. It also could drop bombs and also was a gunship. There's a lot of people that flew those aircraft in Vietnam that did different things than I did. But all I did was carry people and supplies, and a lot of times it was what they call Class A, meaning... ammunition and bombs from the bigger bases to the bases that needed the ordnance for their aircraft or for the Army. A lot lot of times we would take food, a lot of times we'd take mail, a lot of times we'd take people. There was also a mission in which we would go to the smaller bases to pick up bodies, and we would go to four or five different small places and pick up body bags, and anywhere from usually, you know, I don't know, four or five up to 30 or 40,
mm-hmm.
and then bring them back to the bigger bases for shipment back to the United States.
How did you deal with that? How did you handle carrying dead Americans or dead South Vietnamese?
Yeah, well, I didn't do that very well. I mean, I didn't handle that very well. I was young and footloose and fancy free and carefree, and I thought that I guess it was kind of a big joke or a game just to even be there. Didn't really faze me that much, but whenever I had one of those runs, which was fairly often,
mm-hmm.
Once a month maybe, and I was there 2 years,
mm-hmm.
so whenever you had one of those runs, it brought the reality of it all back. And then when occasionally when I'd if we were at altitude on autopilot or sometimes on the ground when we were waiting for people to load the body bags, there were other body bags already on there, and you just go around and they had a little tag on them that was written the person's name and their hometown and their age.
Right.
I remember looking at those and seeing, you know, John Smith, whatever, age 17 or age 19 or whatever, and I'm thinking, you know, this kid ought to be, and I was fairly young myself, but not that young. I was
right.
already 25 or 24.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking this kid here ought to be at the drugstore, you know, playing the pinball machine.
Mm-hmm.
And here he is. We're shipping him home, you know, in a body bag.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would bring the reality of it all back to me for some time until it went away again.
Right. Did you ever pick up wounded?
Yeah, we did. We they had C-130s that actually did that for a living. I mean, did that.
Mm-hmm.
They're called medevac, medical evacuation
mm-hmm.
flights.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally we would be somewhere and there would somebody be wounded, and they didn't have time to wait for a medevac flight, or they wanted to get them to immediate medical attention that wasn't available wherever they were.
Mm-hmm.
But it was never scheduled that way, of course, because you never knew when that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The medical evacuation is a regular route that they'd go around, and it was for people that would receive first aid and be stabilized in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have to wait a day or two, but they would be stabilized and then taken to Cameron Bay or Da Nang or someplace where they had a large hospital, medical facilities and doctors and all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
much more equipment and people than they had for wherever they were coming from,
mm-hmm.
obviously.
Mm-hmm.
We did bring wounded back, but it was not wholesale, nor was it a regular thing, because that was not, I just didn't fly the airplanes that had that as a job. The ones that did the medevac flights were set up with litters
mm-hmm.
in the back and stanchions, and they had a full crew of flight nurses and a doctor and paramedics, and they would have a crew of six or eight medical people besides the flying people that would go around and pick up the ones that were needed the medical attention elsewhere.
Right. Did you ever interact with the wounded that you did carry on those few occasions?
No, I really didn't. Normally speaking, it was a very quick thing. They'd just say, we've got a wounded. I mean, sometimes I wouldn't even see the person. I'd be on the flight deck, and a lot of times we don't shut down our engines.
Mm-hmm.
When we're into a place that's hostile, we keep our engines running.
Mm-hmm.
The C-130 is called the mortar magnet. I don't know if you've heard that term,
mm-hmm.
but there's other airplanes that are also, I think, nicknamed that. But it's kind of hard. A C-130 is a big target, and it's fairly slow, but it's still, when it's flying, it's a target that's at least moving. When you get a C-130 on the ground, you've got a great opportunity there. I know somebody with a little grenade could take out a C-130 while it's on the ground. Much, much easier than trying to get one in the air. So whenever a C-130 was on the ground more than 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, that's when they would lob in the mortars or the grenades or whatever they had, to, because a C-130 sitting on the ground is a tempting target. Mm-hmm. So,
did that ever happen to you on, with your plane?
Yeah, we were under attack. We got lobbed at while we were on the ground. I never got hit.
Right.
I got hit with small arms fire, both flying and on the ground. Mm-hmm. But if you have small arms fire, a C-130 happens to be an airplane with a lot of wing, a lot of tail, a lot of fuselage.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you happen to hit the oil line or the fuel line or the hot air valve or the line that supplies the hot air, unless you hit something like that, the hydraulic line or something, you're not going to hurt a C-130 because it's going to go in the skin and come back out the other side, and there's a lot of space there where there's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no fuel, there's no lines, there's no nothing. So, basically, small arms fire was fairly innocuous in terms of a danger to a C-130 just because there's a lot of space where it's not going to hurt you. So we'd come home sometimes and look around the airplane, and you'd see a few holes in it, and you'd say, well, it looks like we took some small arms fire, or... we may have seen it even.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you never see it. You don't see it. It just happens.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the daylight, you can't see small arms fire. But I guess this all goes back to the point that when you're on the ground, you're a much more tempting target. So for the air crews who do not want to be a target, and for the people that are on the ground receiving your supplies or giving you the people or whatever it is that they need to have taken out of there, don't want you on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's fairly peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
For them otherwise, until you get a C-130 or in the other aircraft on the ground, then it becomes lively for them, and so they want you to be there a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And you only want to be there for a short period of time, so we're both happy to get down, get loaded or unloaded, or unloaded and then loaded if we got something coming and going, and to leave. And so I guess my point is the air crew very seldom leaves the airplane. We very seldom, the aircraft commander, meaning me, the pilot, very seldom leave the seat.
Mm-hmm.
When we're on the ground, because we've got four engines running and we're ready to go within 15 seconds if we need to. And while we're loading, a lot of times, I don't know what it is they're loading, and all I want to do is do it fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, they could come on and they'll say, Lieutenant, we got two wounded. They're going to Cameron, we're ready to go, sir. And so that'd be it. And so I may not even see him, and then we may have been going to somewhere else. But if we got a couple wounded that we just picked up and they need to go to Cameron, well, then we would obviously take off, and instead of going to Benoit or going to Pleiku or someplace where we were supposed to go to,
mm-hmm.
we'd go to Cameron, drop them off, and then go on with our mission. But I may not ever even see the person.
Right.
Or persons or things that we pick up.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not my, you know, my job is to get us off the ground as fast as we can.
Mm-hmm. I know this would depend on whether or not the landing zone was hot or cold, but what do you think was the average amount of time you would spend actually on the ground?
Wow. No more than 10 minutes. Sometimes less.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes less than that. I mean, sometimes 2 or 3 minutes. It felt like, I mean, I didn't time it, but
right.
We knew when it was a little too long. You could tell when it was a little too long. It's, mm-hmm. You get antsy and think, well, this is longer than it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say, yeah, 10 minutes maximum, and probably 3 to 5 minutes would probably be average.
Right.
And that's being on the ground, getting stopped, getting to where you're supposed to go, and you're already got your ramp and door open, and then you start kicking things off, literally kick things off the airplane,
mm-hmm.
or as you're rolling to a stop, they're throwing things on or whatever it is, and people are getting on, and then you start taxiing again, and you're buttoning up about the time that you're given full power, and you're gone again.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you remember the first time you were shot at? When you first experienced the
yeah,
ground fire?
I do. Actually, I do. It wasn't the first time I was shot at, but it was the first time that the reality, I guess, sunk in. And it really wasn't a very hostile situation. We were coming in, I think, to the end of Tontanoop, a fairly secure area. But it happened to be at night, and it was a very clear night, very dark night, and I started seeing tracers below us, and I just kind of looked at it, and
they were coming up to you.
Well, they're coming up below me.
Okay.
Were coming up like below me, and so I kind of turned to the right, and then the tracers turned to follow me.
Mm-hmm.
And then it hit me that, well, you know what, that guy's trying to shoot us down. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Why would he want to do that? I mean, I'm just me. I mean, I'm not trying to hurt him. I don't know why he would want to try to shoot me down. But, yeah, I remember seeing that it's like a little river, a little stream of red.
Mm-hmm.
It was very pretty. but I remember that. Thinking, wow, I wonder why that guy wants to see me down there in the jungle, with a crashed airplane. I remember thinking about that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get it at the time as to why they would be have a hostile attitude towards us, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
When I felt like I had nothing personally against whoever was down there.
Right.
Shooting. And so, yeah, I do remember that. That was, I don't know if that was the first time, but I remember it was the most memorable time anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would you say was, or how would you describe your most perilous mission that you flew there? Or a few of them.
Yeah. Oh, I don't think that any of the missions were, to the point where, well, I mean, of course, any mission something could happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I think probably the hardest thing we did was, regardless of there being any exposure to ordnance or small arms fire or mortars or whatever, probably the hardest thing we did or the most dangerous thing we did was to land in very, very, very short fields,
mm-hmm.
and they were just gravel, and they would cut down a few trees in the jungle, and
mm-hmm.
so you're landing over very high trees in the middle of a jungle in 110 degrees and very wide, very narrow and very short,
mm-hmm.
Very unprepared fields. So you don't really have much margin for error if you land too fast or if you land too long. I mean, you're just going to go off the other end, and there's nothing that you're going to do about it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's going to go into the jungle. So I remember I ended up getting a Distinguished Flying Cross for a mission in which we had that, but it also was under attack at the time. The forward operating base that we were going into evidently had been under attack for about a day, and they had mobilized, I don't know how many helicopters, but more than you can count. Gunships were surrounding the forward operating base, around the perimeter, and there must have been, I don't know, 50 or 100, maybe more than that, helicopters were flying along, and I remember as we were coming in, we had to fly through these helicopters, and that, I thought, was probably one of the most dangerous things we had done, because the helicopters themselves are firing, so they're focusing on what they're firing at, and then they're being fired at, and then they've got other helicopters to worry about, and here comes a big C-130 through the middle of them.
Were you talking with them?
No. Very little communications between Air Force airplanes and Army helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
We could talk to Army sometimes on the ground through what they call Fox Mike radio, FM radio, but we never knew what frequency they were on, and I don't even know if they were on a radio or not a radio. We all had different kinds of radios and whatever. So, no, it was a matter of see and be seen. And so, you know, you come down and you just are looking and you're saying, well, I wonder if these four helicopters see me or not. And they would cross in front of us and below us or whatever. And you know, occasionally you would see that anyone that was getting very, very close to you would then move, would stop or back up or turn right or left or whatever needed to do to get out of your way. But, of course, every second of the way as you're making your approach into the little field, you're ready to take evasive maneuver in case whoever's flying that airplane doesn't happen to see you or is too focused on something else that he's not altering his flight path or whatever. And so we delivered, I think we delivered ammunition there, and that, and we got down on the ground, and we had, it was very exciting, of course, and got down on the ground and got off the ground very quickly and did what they call a combat offload, where what you do is you pull over to get off to the side and just open up the back end, and you just run your engines to full power, and then you release the brakes, and then the pallets themselves are unlocked before that, and then they just slide off your airplane through momentum. You're actually taking the airplane and kind of skidding. The pallets are still there, and you're kind of taking the airplane and going forward and taking the airplane from beneath it. And it's just flies out the back end, and then you close up, and then you're gone. And so you don't even take time to throw anything off. You just everything just flies off your airplane. And so that's what they called a combat offload. We did that probably when it was the hottest combat wise. That was the time that our crew got the Distinguished Flying Cross.
Where was this FOB, do you remember?
Hold on.
Okay.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay. It's called BUDOP. B-U, one word, then D-O-P.
Okay. You described it as exciting. You said it was exciting, of course. Now, people who've never been in combat or has never experienced anything close to this, how could you explain to them what you meant by that?
Oh, well, by that I mean there are times when you can actually fly around Vietnam or other places and fairly routine, and especially if you're going into the bigger bases and sometimes at night and there's not much activity. And even in the daytime, sometimes there's not a lot of activity or fairly routine and regular. But when you get into something like this, which happens, you know, not that often, but maybe once or twice a month, when you get into something like this, now you get a very much heightened sense of alertness. Your adrenaline is very high. Your senses are very keen. You can see and hear everything, and you're mentally and emotionally and physically at your absolute peak, and you're just because that's what I meant by exciting is that your energy level and your emotions and your adrenaline is so high that it's just an exciting time. It's
mm-hmm.
just, it's as opposed to anything that's regular or routine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was referring to.
Okay. So you made this this combat drop, and you took off, and you were taking fire on the ground.
They were firing on the ground. I don't think we got hit. Mm-hmm. I don't remember that particular time of coming home and saying, "Well, we got hit while we were on the ground or in the air." But yes, we did take fire. Well, the helicopters did too. Everybody did.
Did you ever experience fear? Were you conscious of that?
No, I don't think so. I think I experienced wonder as to why they wanted to do something, but I don't think I ever had that. I mean, you get excitement in the sense that you got self-preservation going,
mm-hmm.
But I don't ever recall thinking this is it, or having a conscious feeling or thought that I'm fearful of going into this situation. I think a lot of it had to do with our age.
Right.
And there were a lot of people that were flying 130s that were older than I, that had families and had children, and I don't know what they did.
Right.
I would never do that again. You know, with a family and being 35 years old or whatever, you're more mature, you understand, you don't feel like you're, you know, impenetrable, you don't feel like you're invulnerable, or that, you don't feel like you're immortal, but when you're younger and you just come out of pilot training, you don't experience fear, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember it.
Okay.
Because they instill upon you that you're the world's best pilot, and
mm-hmm.
and something may happen to somebody else, but nothing's going to happen to you.
Right. Tell me how you would approach landing strips.
Well, after a while, it got to be a science, an art and a science. But when you first start out, you have to do it fairly mechanically. Meaning that you have to know what your altitude is, what your airspeed is. You are constantly looking at items or building or whatever it is on the ground, or the trees or whatever, and you're doing things sort of by the book, and the way they tell you to do it. Whereas as you get more experience, the way you approach a landing zone is really by feel. And you do it so often and so much
mm-hmm.
that it's I can feel that I'm going the right speed or one or two knots too fast or one or two knots too slow. I don't have to look at my airspeed indicator. I already
mm-hmm.
know. I don't have to know what my altitude is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to look down at my altimeter to see, because I can tell that I'm in the right spot or a little high or a little low
mm-hmm.
or whatever. I mean, it's just anybody would. Anybody that would do that often enough gets to be so good at it that it's a feel thing.
How long did it take you to develop that kind of feel?
It takes a little while. I would say probably a month. It probably takes 10 or 12 or 15 missions where you do that 7 or 8 times
mm-hmm.
each mission, meaning you might take off in 6 o'clock in the morning, and you'll fly till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You might make 7 or 8 or 10 landings
mm-hmm.
in those hours.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the flights are an hour and a half, and sometimes the flights are 10 minutes,
mm-hmm.
Depending on what your mission is. But yeah, I would say probably you do that for 15 or 20 times over a 30-day period, and you do that 6 or 7 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
By then, you're pretty good. Good.
How would you actually come, what altitude would you be? What angle of descent would you have?
Generally speaking, what you want is the higher the altitude and the bigger the sink rate, the better. And of course, the reason for that is if you are low and slow and dragging over the trees, you give yourself more exposure.
Mm-hmm.
If you're higher and you can get your airspeed down to, you know, practically nothing, and then bring it straight down to the end of the runway and break your descent at exactly the right spot and hit the LZ in the shortest spot possible without being short and hit the trees, the better off you are. So I don't know that there was an... I don't remember that if there was an angle that they told us to do it at, or whether it was a taught thing by being in the airplane. But, of course, you would have parameters. You never wanted to be more than 500 to 600 feet per minute rate of descent because it's hard to break that, and you never want to be below your threshold landing speed because you don't have any margin for error for stall.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. So, yeah, we had parameters, but I don't think we, you know, we had absolutes. They were just targets.
Right. I've interviewed quite a few individuals who were passengers on C-130s, and they said that descent would just scare hell out of them.
Yeah. Well, that's what, for the reason I just said, you know, if you can take it at a steep descent, that would give you the best, the shortest exposure time than if you did like an airliner coming out from 10 miles away, gradually starting a descent. You know, that's no good.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's no good. And so, of course, what these people are maybe talking about, too, is the way you did it from base to base is that you took off from one base and you climbed straight up to 10,000 feet or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go what's called feet wet to the coast,
mm-hmm.
fly up the coast or down the coast, and then you come back in to where you are going. And then at 10,000 feet, you circle straight down over the top
mm-hmm.
because that's your cone of best security.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't gradually start from way back. And so it's not just the approach, but they're probably talking about from altitude where you just dump full flaps and
right.
all four engines to flight idle. And then from 10,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
you spiral straight down. Then that's not just the approach in the last, you know, 1,000 feet to the touchdown, but from 10,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
From the back, it really looks scary. From the front, it doesn't look so scary.
Right.
But from the back, yeah, I've done it myself in the back, and I'm thinking, wow, this is what it looks like from the back, huh? And it is pretty scary looking.
Plus you're in control up front.
Yeah, plus we're in control, and we're, you know, we got full vision, we can see, and we're doing it, and...
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot different. You're right. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're out of time here for today. Why don't we go ahead and take a break?
Okay, that sounds great.